How to win friends and influence Democrats, Brexit begins, and correctly predicting death with computers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, March 28th. Thank you for joining us. President Trump and congressional Republicans are moving on from health care for the moment and pivoting to tax reform. There is some heavy lifting ahead of them. The appropriations bill they passed last year expires at the end of April. And with Republicans divided, the GOP will probably need Democrats to pass a funding package. And they are not getting along. So where might a compromise lie? Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
If Republicans were feeling down following the defeat of the health care bill, they won't have much time to sit around feeling sorry for themselves, says Maya McGinnis of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
They have to pass some kind of a continuing resolution to keep the government open for the rest of the year. They have to pass a budget for next year, and they have to lift that debt ceiling sometime early fall.
And all of that is before they can get to the fun stuff, like cutting taxes and spending big on infrastructure. Mark Harkins from Georgetown's Government Affairs Institute points out that the politics of that nut just got really hard to crack.
There are fractures inside the Republican Party that will make this difficult. And the president offering up $18 billion worth of cuts and non-defense programs are not going to make any friends with the Democrats.
While steep spending cuts may appeal to some conservative House members, they'll have a much harder sell among Senate Democrats and moderate Republicans.
They're not going to stand for some of these cuts that their own constituents don't like, but also plenty of Republican constituencies don't like them either.
Norm Ornstein is with the conservative American Enterprise Institute. He says getting eight Democratic senators to support the president's plan is just not going to happen.
So they've got a rocky road ahead, and I'm skeptical we can get through this without at least one bout of a shutdown.
Ornstein says one option might be to pass a so-called clean continuing resolution, funding the government at 2016 levels through the rest of the fiscal year, meaning another delay on Trump's promised spending cuts. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
At the Environmental Protection Agency today, President Trump signed an executive order seeking to undo several climate-related regulations, regulations on power plants, oil and gas drilling. The order also called for more leasing of land for coal mining. It tries to clear the road for domestic energy production. And it orders a formal review of President Obama's clean power plan. For a closer look, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk in Washington. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Molly.
So help me prioritize. What are the most important pieces coming out of this from the perspective of energy companies and the climate?
Well, I'll give you one piece. By far, what's gotten the most attention is a set of rules on power plants that exist today. It's called the Clean Power Plan, which actually hasn't taken effect yet, but it would basically speed up the decline of coal-fired power plants, which is the dirtiest source of electricity, and it's reeling because coal already can't compete with natural gas. Now, the White House says it will initiate a review of the Clean Power Plan, which doesn't really sync up with the verbs this president tends to use, but it's because it takes a lot of steps. There's a lot of uncertainty. If you want to rescind or revise a regulation that's on the books, you have to go through all these steps as if you were passing a new one. You have to draft language, you have to ask the public to comment, you have to do your analysis, and then you have to gear up for a legal fight, says Ethan Shankman. I spoke to him today. He's a former career lawyer at the EPA and the Justice Department, and now he's at the firm Arnold & Porter.
Virtually anything EPA does of any significance is challenged in court, and sometimes it's challenged by industry or the regulated community. Sometimes it's challenged by environmental groups. Sometimes it's challenged by states. The one thing that we can say with certainty is there will be litigation.
And these legal machinations and uncertainty apply to a whole host of things in this executive order, Molly. So a lot of we don't know going on.
So let's say, though, that it gets through all of those legal challenges. It somehow goes through in its entirety or close to. How does that change the U.S. emissions outlook?
Well, that analysis has been done, and U.S. emissions have been falling for a number of years, mostly because of market forces, but then they would flatten out, according to a new analysis of the Trump executive order. So coal would get a little bit of a lifeline, and so our emissions would flatten and certainly fall short of the U.S. goal in the Paris Global Climate Agreement.
Well, let's talk about that coal lifeline and also how it potentially affects the rest of the energy markets.
Well, with regard to coal, I've spoken to a lot of people. I went to the coal mining areas of Illinois recently, talked to executives, utility analysts. Nobody has told me that coal is going to come back to where it once was. There are just so many market things going on here. As far as other types of energy, you know, state policies continue to demand a lot of solar and wind and renewable energy. And natural gas is the biggest story driving all of this. We have a lot of this in the United States. So in a way, technology fracking has already kind of made U.S. oil and gas great again. So that's going to keep driving things. And with regard to coal, it's, you know, deregulation can only get you so far.
Marketplace's Scott Tong, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
On Wall Street today, the Dow stops its slide thanks to banks and oil. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Brexit starts tomorrow. UK Prime Minister Theresa May will officially begin the 2-year process of pulling her country out of the European Union. Her two key goals: to keep the closest possible trading links with the EU and to end the automatic right of EU citizens to settle in Britain. But even before the Brexit talks begin, the flow of EU nationals into the UK has been slowing down fast. From our European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The effects have been felt in farming, manufacturing and the hotel trade. Fewer EU nationals have applied for jobs in Britain since last year's vote for Brexit. The impact, says Alex Salmond, former head of the Scottish Government, has been most worrying in the nursing profession.
The nurse registrations from Europe have dropped 75% since Brexit. In a full year, that will mean there will be 7,000 less qualified nurses from elsewhere in the European Union working in our National Health Service.
The sharp fall in the pound may have deterred some EU migrants. It's cut the value of any remittances they might want to send home. Others blame Prime Minister May for failing to reassure the 2.3 million EU workers already in Britain. Poonam Burley of the KPMG consulting firm has come across many EU employees deeply anxious about their future.
People asking questions such as, will this prevent me being promoted? Will I have to go home? Am I no longer welcome here?
Britain's construction industry is also anxious about the future. It's fretting about the fate of the 175,000 EU migrants working on construction sites around the country. If they went home, the UK could face a labour shortage, says Jeff Matsu of the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors.
It would jeopardise a predicted £500 billion of projected projects in the pipeline.
Last night, a government minister said those EU nationals already here have nothing to worry about. He added future flows will be managed in the national interest. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We've said it. President Trump said it. Even House Speaker Paul Ryan said it. Obamacare is here to stay for now. Conservatives must work within the confines of the Affordable Care Act, but Tom Price, as head of Health and Human Services, can still make a lot of changes on his own. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Earlier this month, Secretary Price tweeted, quote, "There are 1,442 citations in the ACA where it says the secretary shall or the secretary may. We'll look at every single one."
An administration that's committed to undermining the ACA is really only limited by its imagination.
Jill Horwitz is a law professor at UCLA. Without help from Congress, Horwitz says Republicans can't change the law, but rules on how to execute the law are fair game.
The ACA, the legislation, was the skeleton, and the Obama administration put the meat on the bones. And if the Trump administration wants to undo the ACA, it can work systematically to take the meat off the bones.
One place some of that meat may come off: the essential health benefits. That's the list of 10 benefits insurers must cover. It includes hospitalizations, prescription drugs, mental health services, and maternity care. It's not like the Trump administration will cut the 10 benefits down to 4, but Joe Antos with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says it's more like they could limit the scope of the whole thing.
The question isn't, will maternity coverage, as an example, be eliminated, but rather, what constitutes adequate coverage for maternity benefits?
Antos expects Republicans to look at watering down benefits with an eye towards lowering premiums. Of course, that would drive up costs for people who need care. It's the kind of quandary Republicans will continue to wrestle with as long as they remain in Obamacare handcuffs. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Ford Motor Company announced a $1.2 billion investment into U.S. facilities this morning, although technically President Trump beat them to the punch. He tweeted that car companies like Ford are bringing jobs back to the U.S. Ford said 130 jobs would be created or retained by its moves, and Ford said just $350 million of the $1.2 billion are actually new investments. Some of the others had been announced as long ago as 2015. We got Ford's Executive Vice President of the Americas, Jim Hinrichs, on the phone to tell us what today's announcement means. Jim, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Your announcement today says the plan will create or retain 130 jobs there in Michigan. Do you have any sense of how that breakdown looks?
Yes, the actual new jobs are all at the Romeo engine plant, 130 of them. We say create or retain because we redeploy some of efficiencies and other things that happen on a normal basis in our plant. So there's 130 incremental jobs created in the Romeo engine plant, but there won't be 130 direct hires. There will be some because we'll redeploy some resources. Another big important part of this investment, though, is that without this investment, 3,600 employees at Michigan Assembly Plant would be without work. And so protecting those 3,600 jobs with this investment is also a big deal.
And let me ask you, though, was there a plan to get rid of those jobs? Like, does this represent a strategy change? Because even in January, when you announced that you would be keeping the car factory here and not moving to Mexico, CEO Mark Field said that that was a move that probably would have happened regardless of the current political administration. So how much of a change in plans does this represent aside from just a business growth?
Yeah, the major investments have been in the works for quite some time, so I wouldn't call any of that a change in plans. The January investment to put $700 million into Flat Rock Assembly Plant was a change in plans. We had not decided where to build those products, and so we made that decision in December. The production of Ranger and Bronco and Michigan Assembly Plant has been in the works for quite some time. And, of course, the new engine components for Romeo has been in the works for quite some time. The data center's decision has been made in the last 6-9 months. That's been an incremental decision.
Is it okay that President Trump takes credit for these moves? I mean, it seems to be a little bit of a game back and forth.
We reached out to the White House a little before 8 a.m. this morning to give them a heads up on the news we're going to be making today. We had not had conversations with them prior to that time period.
And is that common? Was your government affairs team in contact with President Obama, too, about?
Yes. On a major announcement, we would let all stakeholders know in advance to give them a heads up. And obviously, it's good news, so we want to share it with everybody, from governors to senators and congressmen and women to the White House. We do that often on big announcements, yes.
Obviously, this administration is different in terms of direct engagement with companies by name on Twitter. That is obviously uncharted territory. But how common is it for the winds of the political administration to direct your business strategy?
Well, we have to make decisions for, you know, decades. So we don't get the luxury of making decisions that are, you know, 4 years in nature. And so our decisions are really taken into account where we see long-term things going. But we do actually are watching very carefully the pro-growth initiatives that the Trump administration is pursuing, especially on tax reform and infrastructure investment and how that could affect the industry, both in the medium term and the long term.
So would you say it affects your PR strategy more than your business strategy?
Well, we're certainly adjusting to some changes in what's going on and the attention in the auto industry and attention on manufacturing jobs. But it suits very well, you know, our plan. I mean, we're the largest producer of vehicles in the United States, and we employ more manufacturing workers than anybody else in the auto industry. So, you know, it fits really nicely with our priorities and where our plans have been for quite some time.
That's Joe Hinrichs, Ford, President of the Americas. Thank you so much for your time, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
machines can see the world and can see patients in ways that we cannot as doctors.
as in they can see when those patients might pass away. But first, let's do the numbers. They are back. A rally in bank stocks led U.S. indices to higher numbers on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 150 points, 7-tenths percent, to close at 20,701. The NASDAQ was up 34 points, 6-tenths percent, to finish at 5,875. And the S&P 500 gained 16 points, 7-tenths percent, to close at 2,358. General Motors investor David Einhorn is pressuring that automaker to lure new investors by taking a risk and creating two classes of common stock. He said it'll boost their capitalization by as much as $38 billion. GM says no thank you, and today gained 2 4/10%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note was 2.41%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. California's Central Valley is an agricultural powerhouse. And for much of the last half century, it's been ground zero for a couple crops in particular. One of them is raisins. There's a town outside Fresno named Raisin City. The official motto of the California town of Selma is Raisin Capital of the World. For many families, it's the only thing they know how to do. But with falling prices and more foreign competition, many of those families are struggling to keep their farms afloat. Marketplace's Andy Euler visited some of them.
John Pabujan Jr. had just celebrated his 80th birthday when I met him at his family farm a few miles from Selma, California. John's got about 450 acres of raisin vineyards here and has been working this land for 75 years.
I remember when I was about 4 or 5 years old, my grandfather had 60 acres across the street from my dad. They'd put me on the tractor. All I did was steer the tractor when I could stop it. Grandpa would get on it, turn around, put it in another row.
Back then, his grandparents needed all the help they could get. They picked the crop entirely by hand. That land today?
My cousin owns the 60 acres right now.
As demanding as this work is, John didn't limit himself to just raisins.
I would do the farming during the week. On the weekends, I was at rodeos.
Competing as a calf roper. Apparently, a pretty good one.
I was runner-up in 69. I ended up second in the world that year.
John says he quit roping at rodeos 10 years ago, though he reckons he could still do it if you ask him. But he's very busy and spends most of his time out here on the farm. His pickup truck is a makeshift office.
Come here, get in the pickup. These are two of my grandsons I'm teaching them because I just turned 80. My wife says something happens to you. What am I going to do with all this?
All this being the farms and the American Raisin Packing Plant up the road that John also owns. Plant manager Terry Bertrand showed me around.
And what it's doing here, it comes up here, the conveyor belt.
For about 15 years, John's eldest son, Greg, ran this packing plant. But he decided to go out on his own, selling bird feed at first and eventually getting into almonds. This packing plant is up for sale for a few million dollars, but he says he'll probably end up giving it to Greg to keep it in the family.
If he can make it in almonds, that's fine. It won't be original plant no more. It'll be strictly almonds. This raisin industry is depressed.
John understands the reality, and nostalgia won't pay the bills. Raisin farmers and the packers who sell the produce settled on a price last month for last year's crop, $1,100. That's down 31% from last year.
All these farmers, they're pulling them out now because they can't make it.
Labor cost and government regulation are two things farmers are struggling with. Then there are foreign competitors like Turkey, which sell raisins cheaper. Many raisin farmers are pulling up their vineyards and turning to crops like almonds, pistachios, or clementines where there's more money to be made. Or they're just selling the land. Kalen Barsarian, CEO of the Raisin Bargaining Association, says he doesn't blame them.
You can't believe how many friends with 40 and 80 acres I've talked into selling. Guys, cash it out.
John Pabujan won't hear it. He feels good about the future of his farms and feels like he built something that'll last.
Do I consider it a success? Yeah. When you got 1,000 acres and you bring in $1 million crop every year, you got to be successful to do that.
John would love it if his grandkids could make a go of it as raisin farmers, but he's advising them not to. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
In the tech world, the big conversations right now are all about artificial intelligence and machine learning, the idea that computers can take huge amounts of data and use the information to solve problems and make predictions, big predictions, like maybe even when you are going to die. Now, we're not quite there, but we're also not that far off, and it's not actually a bad thing. Dr. Ziad Obermeyer is a practicing ER doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. He's been researching how machines can predict the life expectancy of patients with serious or life-limiting illnesses. Ziad, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks so much for having me.
So back at the beginning of your research, you were an ER doctor. You saw that it was difficult for doctors to tell patients that they might die. But do you feel like this was a communication problem or a prognostication problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of people working on the communication side. In other words, how doctors should bring up the subject of death and dying to patients. I think that the prerequisite for that is that the doctors actually need to know about it beforehand. And there's a lot of research suggesting that doctors are just not very good at predicting death. That's, I think, the impetus for a lot of my work, is that machines can see the world and can see patients in ways that we cannot as doctors, and can start helping us with some of these difficult predictions that we would like to make in our clinical practice, but just don't have the ability to.
What are the benefits? It sounds like there are many. What are the benefits of knowing when someone is going to die, of being able to predict that fairly accurately?
Yeah, I think there are some direct benefits to patients. There are a lot of surveys that have been done of people who are living with serious illnesses that are life-limiting. And one thing that those patients really, really want and aren't getting from doctors is objective predictions about how long they have to live. Doctors are very reluctant to answer those kinds of questions, partly because, you know, you don't want to be wrong about something so important, but also partly because there's a sense that patients don't want to know. And in fact, that turns out not to be true when you actually ask the patients. People do want to know because it helps them to put their affairs in order, both kind of logistically and emotionally, and make all the arrangements that need to be made.
In the article you co-authored for the New England Journal of Medicine, you wrote that AI or the machine learning could disrupt the healthcare industry, especially imaging and radiology. Will machine learning be for radiologists what automation was or is for manufacturing?
I think there are very big changes coming to medicine, and I think it's going to have a lot of implications. First, for the kinds of doctors that are, in essence, translating things from digital pictures to digital reports, because that translation can now increasingly be done by a machine. And so I think increasingly over the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to see a lot of that work being displaced by machines. There's always going to be a place for humans. In other words, we still have pilots flying planes, even though we have autopilot. But I think it's going to change the industry quite a bit as those technologies come online.
Well, yeah, now we're talking about in the context of palliative care. How much longer do you think it's going to be before one of these machines can predict a relatively healthy person's death?
I think it's all part of the same algorithm. I think we, for example, use the a lot of the data from the Harvard hospital systems. Those data cover a lot of young patients just as well as old patients, and the algorithm performs just as well across all age groups, genders, races. And so when you have the data and you have a well-measured outcome like death, predicting anyone's likelihood of death in the next year is pretty easy.
Would you want to know?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think it's a little scary, but it's hard to turn down knowledge when you're given the option of knowing.
Ziad Obermeyer, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This final note before we go. Snap, the maker of Snapchat, has had its ups and downs since its IPO earlier this month. It had a great day yesterday when several analyst reports gave it a buy rating. Most of those, turns out, were underwriters of Snap, who have a waiting period after an IPO before they can hype the stocks they're invested in. But Snap shares sank again today after Facebook announced new features that are exactly what Snapchat does. Filtered cameras, disappearing messages and stories. Snap shares dropped 4%, even though MarketWatch notes that this is the fourth time Facebook has directly copied Snapchat in the last 7 months, first in Instagram, then in Messenger and WhatsApp, and now in the core Facebook app. But it doesn't always pay to be first. Facebook shares up about 1%. All right, we got to go. Nice little day on Wall Street. Today, the Dow gained 150 points. The NASDAQ was up 34 points, and the S&P 500 gained 16 points. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan are producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer of our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I am Molly Wood. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.